often say was my first pandemic. We were just trying to figure out what to do.
5 years after COVID was declared a global pandemic, reflections on its impact on the faithful. We go in depth on the lingering effects of COVID isolation and what the Catholic Church can do better in the next health crisis.
I'm asking, you know, where am I needed now? You know, what is this moment about?
Out of a job and global aid to those in need cut off. We talked to fired workers and the former head of Catholic Relief Services about the way forward after the loss of federal funding.
Situation of war that pushed me and pushed so many immigrants to leave their countries.
He entered the United States an undocumented immigrant, now an American citizen and a high-ranking Catholic clergyman. This bishop shares his unique view on the church's role in immigration. And the theatrical version of the story of Jesus. We talked to the creator and the lead actor in the play, now touring the country in celebration of Lent. EWTN's News in Depth starts now. Blessing to a world in desperate need of hope. 5 years ago this month, on March 27, 2020, Pope Francis stood on the rainy steps of St. Peter's Basilica and delivered an Orbi et Orbi blessing to people across the globe, asking God to bring healing and peace to those suffering from the spread of COVID-19. An empty and lifeless St. Peter's Square highlighted the fear and isolation brought on by the pandemic. But the Holy Father's message of hope and courage touched the hearts of millions. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Rasal Regis, in this week for Catherine Hadrow. 5 years ago, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic, leading to a devastating period of isolation, sickness, and fear for the entire world. It changed the way we communicate, the way we work, and the way we worship. And its lingering effects can still be seen in the U.S. church today.
We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
5 years ago, the World Health Organization declared an international health crisis, setting in motion a months-long lockdown. Businesses shuttered, millions of jobs were lost, and large gatherings became off-limits. Unable to go to school or work, Americans were isolated in their homes. Many feared for their lives as they watched the death toll climb. According to the data from the CDC, more than 1.2 million Americans have lost their lives to the virus since 2020. Deaths reached an all-time high at the beginning of 2021, with more than 25,000 deaths during the week of January 9th. All this with many Catholics unable to turn to their church for the sacraments, the core of the Catholic faith, and a vital source of God's grace.
So we know this is very tough. It's tough for us, and it's certainly tough for the people. We really miss each other and being able to be together.
COVID-19 left priests in a delicate balance of providing for their flocks while also following local restrictions. Many masses moved online, some communities held services outdoors, others offered communion to parishioners right in their cars. In Lansing, Michigan, one priest took Eucharistic adoration to the skies, processing with the Blessed Sacrament 10,000 feet above his diocese in an airplane. Some of those most affected by the pandemic were Catholics in the hospital, suffering alone, often without physical contact with their loved ones. Cardinal Sean O'Malley, then the head of Archdiocese of Boston, created a task force of priests to quarantine and administer sacraments to those patients. Father Ryan Connors, one of the members of that task force, says serving the sick during the pandemic was a profound experience.
It was a manifestation of the church's closeness to people to ensure that even in this difficult time of the pandemic, the preaching of the gospel and the administration of the sacraments, so far as possible, was able to continue.
COVID-19 also had a devastating impact on school children, whose math and reading scores plummeted. The church recognized the need for students to safely attend school in person. The National Catholic Educational Association found more than 90% of Catholic schools opened safely 5 days a week with hybrid options during the 2020 to 2021 school year, compared to just 56% of public schools.
Personally, it was so fun. I mean, I'm so happy my parents chose to send me back because, I mean, I couldn't imagine doing this online school another year.
Catholics also fought to keep their churches open, though many states began to allow indoor services with social distancing and capacity limits. Some created outright bans, even as secular businesses and gatherings were allowed to reopen. Catholics in California, Minnesota, New York, Washington, D.C., and Wisconsin filed lawsuits against these restrictions, and courts overwhelmingly sided with the churches.
The courts started to say to the government, hey, what's your reason or what's your proof for thinking church is more dangerous than a casino or some other activity? Turns out the governments didn't have proofs.
Now, more than a dozen states legally protect religious gatherings as essential. But even as churches reopened their doors during the pandemic, some typical mass goers were still hesitant to return to mass. Georgetown University's Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate, or CARA, tracks weekly mass attendance. Before the pandemic, about a quarter of self-identified Catholics attended weekly Mass. That number dropped to 15% for most of the pandemic. Dr. Mark Gray, senior research associate at CARA, says Mass attendance returned to pre-pandemic levels in 2023. Though Sunday Mass is an obligation in the Catholic faith, Gray says many Catholics still tune into online Mass.
The unusual thing is that even though in-person attendance is back to normal, that search volume for Catholic Mass on YouTube remains elevated.
But he says the data shows Catholic resilience.
People found ways to continue to practice their faith and in some ways became even more prayerful and relied on their faith to get through some of the harder times of the pandemic.
To further discuss the church and COVID-19, we are joined by Dan Salucci, CEO of the Catholic Leadership Institute. His organization has been at the forefront of analyzing COVID's impact on the faithful. Dan, it's been 5 years since the COVID-19 pandemic hit the world. Looking back, how did the church accompany the faithful during that difficult and isolating period?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I think we can look back at that time and see a lot of things we'd like to do maybe differently, but I think there's a lot of things to celebrate too. The church pivoted pretty quickly to start streaming Mass, to get communication out, to adapt to new technologies, not only streaming, but things like digital communications, like I'm reaching with you right now. And so I think for an organization that's not known to move quickly, I think we pivoted pretty quickly, and I think we're able to provide relationship and connection to our people in a relatively short time.
Yeah, and you kind of touched on this already. How has COVID-19 changed the Catholic Church?
Yes, well, in some ways, dramatically, we lost a lot of folks quickly. We've been able to gain, I think, most of them back by most of the research that we've seen and that we've done. However, we still have some folks who have not returned, I think, from those who were attending before. COVID also showed us or highlighted some of the instability in some of our parish communities that was probably there already, but became a lot more clear during the pandemic. And so some of those parishioners who were maybe coming but not as actively engaged, I think you saw that fall away in that time. On the plus side, though, again, things like technology, ways to communicate, I think a lot of diocesan and parish kind of functions have gotten a little bit more efficient. We can meet different ways. We can figure out different ways to communicate, a lot more comfort with email communication, text communication, some really important means of reaching our people. I think COVID actually catalyzed that for the church and allowed us to kind of get a little bit closer up to speed on some of those important ways that people are communicating.
Right, different circumstances. And many parishes still provide live streams of their masses, like what you mentioned. It's a grace for homebound and ill parishioners, but those healthy and able are obligated to attend in person. So how can churches provide this ministry for the homebound while also encouraging other parishioners to begin attending in person again?
You're right. There's some really good reasons why we should continue to live stream in addition to the ones that you mentioned. You know, it's been a nice way for people who might be mourning a loved one from afar to be able to at least watch the funeral mass or a wedding via live stream. So there's some, again, continued benefits to live streaming. But I think, as you mentioned, we do have an obligation to attend every week. And so I think what we have to do is be careful that in those technologies that we're using and being present in a digital way, that we're always inviting people back into the incarnational experience that we believe is so important. And so those forms of invitation can take many forms, but I think a parish has to be really leading with that invitation to come, to be a part of the real presence that we believe is present during the Mass. And so whether that's actually speaking to those who are live streaming and acknowledging their presence, acknowledge and with gratitude that they are tuning in, but also inviting them to come and check out the beauty of the real presence in the Mass. I think simple ways like that we see are helping to bridge that divide.
Right. And Dan, Pope Francis marked the 12th anniversary of his pontificate this week. Many remember the powerful moment when he said the Urbi et Orbi blessing in an empty St. Peter Square 5 years ago, which we showed at the top of our program. How did the Holy Father guide the church during the pandemic?
Well, I think, you know, the Holy Father, from the beginning of his pontificate and certainly now, has always been about telling us who God is. God is love, God is truth, God is mercy, and how important it is that we be in relationship with each other, in relationship with God. And so I think that moment that you highlighted, that one speaks to my heart still 5 years later. It brought me to tears then. It brought me to tears watching it in this segment. But I think that that witness of who we are together in Christ is what the Holy Father really just has always highlighted and what I've really appreciated about his leadership.
Yes, and right now there's a lot of things going on in our nation. What do you think people here in the U.S. should do to better our church as a whole?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, among all the trends that we're tracking, and you know, a lot of them are not necessarily the most encouraging, but there are a few real glimmers of hope that I would just point out and I think provide us with an opportunity here in the United States. For one, while it's not great, we have returned basically to pre-pandemic levels of mass attendance from 2020. And so, again, that's still only about a quarter of us. We have a lot of room to grow there. However, you also notice that there's a flattening of those who are non-affiliated to any religion. So, in other words, that hasn't grown much since COVID. And I think that's people really feeling a yearning to be in that real relationship. And they might not know that they want to be Catholic yet, but we have the opportunity to invite them into this wonderful life in Christ. And then the last thing that I would say is we have to keep in mind that we now live in a country and a culture that has two generations that may have never actually had an experience of faith. So we have to keep in mind that people might not be rejecting it. They may have actually never experienced it. And that can make us feel sad at times, but again, I think it's a great opportunity to propose the gospel for the first time, to invite people into this wonderful life and not make assumptions about why they're not coming or why they've stopped coming. A lot of times in our research, we see people have just kind of slowly drifted so that they're not angry. They're not necessarily rejecting it. They just maybe need a little bit of a pullback. And I think that's all of our opportunity to do. And we have plenty of opportunities to do it in the United States of America.
Exactly. Well, Dan, thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
The power of prayer continues to strengthen Pope Francis, who has now spent one full month hospitalized in Rome's Gemelli Hospital. The pontiff has received increasingly positive medical news on his recovery from a complex lung infection. The public continues to flock to the hospital to pray, light candles, and leave messages at the base of a statue of St. John Paul II. On Thursday, Pope Francis marked the 12th anniversary of his pontificate while under medical observation and receiving therapy. Despite the improving prognosis, the Pope's doctors say his health remains fragile because of his age and the seriousness of his illness. The Archdiocese of Washington welcomed a new archbishop this week.
With faith in our Lord Jesus Christ and with the love of God in my heart, I do accept the pastoral care of the people of God in the Archdiocese of Washington.
Cardinal Robert McElroy was installed on Tuesday before more than 3,500 people at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, America's largest Catholic church. The 71-year-old McElroy replaces Cardinal Wilton Gregory, who at 77 years old had passed the required retirement age. McElroy is a well-known advocate for immigration rights, echoing the Pope's vision of a welcoming church focused on the poor and marginalized. He takes leadership of an archdiocese already facing a budget crunch, and now fallout from the Trump administration's cuts to social welfare programs. Up next on EWTN News in Depth, we explore the fallout from those cuts when we talk to now laid off and fired workers who are devoting their lives to helping others.
With Trump administration cuts to foreign aid, what impact will it have on vulnerable populations around the world? I'm Mark Irons with that story coming up.
One of the things that immigrants bring to this nation is hope and the desire to work hard.
A bishop who fled his native country because of war goes on the record about immigrants coming to America.
The thorn is like what the Passion of the Christ is for movies and what The Chosen is for TV, the thorn is for theater.
Centered in Christ, storytelling of the life of Jesus on the big stage, unlike what people may have seen before. Coming up, we will talk to one of the lead actors from The Thorn.
Help other people, and for me that's what makes America great, is that we have these amazing resources that we can share with the rest of the world.
Told to clean out their desk in 15 minutes, fired USAID workers open up to talk about program eliminations that have sent shockwaves around the globe as aid is cut off to millions, along with the American soft power that goes with it. The back-and-forth battle over mass firings of federal workers continues in the courts. This week, a federal judge in San Francisco ordered the Trump administration reinstate thousands of probationary workers across multiple agencies in a lawsuit filed by a coalition of labor unions. The judge ruled the firings did not follow federal law. It is but one of several cases challenging the administration's attempts to dramatically downsize the federal workforce. But the situation appears clear-cut at USAID, which funded humanitarian and foreign aid work around the world. At the direction of the Trump administration, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency gutted the USAID workforce in January. And this week, after a six-week review, Secretary of State Marco Rubio made it official, announcing 83% of USAID programs are now eliminated. Reporter Mark Irons talked to shell-shocked laid-off workers.
For President Trump, downsizing the federal government is a top priority.
We're cutting numbers that, you know, nobody's ever seen before.
But Peter Gaff says the cuts come with costs, and vulnerable people around the world who received U.S. foreign aid will pay with their lives.
People will die because of this, particularly children who are suffering from severe acute malnutrition who won't be able to get the treatment that they need. They will die. They will waste away and die.
Gaff is one of the many former federal workers with the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. He was in the agency's Bureau for Humanitarian Assistance. He says his work helped provide life-saving assistance to people impacted by terrorism in West African countries.
People are being killed. They're fleeing their homes. There are millions of displaced people who need access to water. They need food assistance. They need health care. We were funding that for them.
Federal agencies are in the crosshairs of the Trump administration. And soon after the president was sworn in, one of them received its eviction notice. At USAID headquarters in Washington, the sign was quickly removed from the building. People were laid off like Gaff. And on the last day in February, he came out to support fellow workers who were told to pack up their personal belongings and leave.
These are really committed professional people who've dedicated their lives to helping others. They're being kicked to the curb, and it's horrible. It's really difficult. This does make our country less secure. It makes us less safe. It makes us less strong.
But the Trump administration sees the funding cuts and firings as necessary. On Monday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said on X, after a six-week review, we are officially canceling 83% of the programs at USAID.
The 5,200 contracts that are now canceled spent tens of billions of dollars in ways that did not serve, and in some cases even harmed, the core national interest of the United States. Rubio said approximately 1,000 remaining programs of USAID will be kept and administered more effectively under the State Department. This week, a federal judge ruled President Trump overstepped his authority by trying to shut down foreign aid funding that had already been approved by Congress, and said billions of dollars will still have to be paid out. But he did not order Trump officials to use the money to save the terminated program contracts. Elon Musk, with the Department of Government Efficiency, says his work, supported by President Trump, is about rooting out waste and abuse in government spending.
The people voted for major government reform, and that's what people are going to get. They're going to get what they voted for.
President Trump has claimed much of foreign aid was wasteful and advanced a liberal agenda. We spoke with USAID workers who said the agency has worked alongside U.S. presidents over the years in a way that respects the different priorities of their administrations. Devin, another USAID worker whose position was terminated, says government reform could make sense, but she doesn't understand why spending cuts began at USAID.
You don't start with an agency whose budget is less than 1% of the United States government budget. The work we were doing was critically important for a very, very small fraction of the budget.
USAID was established through an act of Congress and executive order from President John F. Kennedy in 1961. Former employee Noel Cohn hopes Congress will act now.
I think there are a lot of Republicans who are really upset. I think there are a lot of Democrats who are really upset. But they need to come up with a plan. They need to say something. They need to do something.
Another USAID worker, afraid to share his name, was also unsure about the future for himself and his fellow coworkers.
I mean, the past month has really just been a nightmare, at least to me, the purity of intention that we had going into all this work and day in, day out, giving our best to do this work, and to see it all just torn down pretty recklessly and indiscriminately is just sad.
The impact isn't just felt by federal workers. Those involved in the charitable work of the Catholic Church are also affected. Catholic Relief Services relies on sources of government funding to give aid to vulnerable populations around the globe.
In CRS's cases, it's between 50% and 60% of its funding. USAID was a big part of that funding. And as you know, USAID has been dismantled.
Maria Jessup was recently laid off as an employee of Catholic Relief Services. She says vital CRS programs that provided food, water, and health care offered stability and peace.
These programs have a direct impact. When people go hungry, they're going to do desperate things. They will join a violent extremist organization. They will migrate somewhere where it's safer. And our programs very much tackle those kinds of root cause issues that lead to conflict, that lead to displacement.
Though the outlook is bleak at the moment, Jessup hopes the work of Catholic Relief Services will receive much needed support.
Our organization is doing its best to advocate with the new administration about the value of this work, and we continue to hold out hope that we can change minds.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
With the federal cuts, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops released a statement this week saying the annual collection for Catholic Relief Services is urgent. The bishops said many partnerships with local organizations are irreparably harmed, and the continuation of any critical work will come down to parishioner support. This year's collection is scheduled for the weekend of March 29th and 30th. Joining us to discuss the ramifications of the Trump administration's foreign aid cuts and the wide-ranging impact on Catholic social welfare programs, we are joined by Carolyn Wu. She is the former president and CEO of Catholic Relief Services. Before her retirement, she led CRS from 2012 to 2016. Carolyn, you have deep knowledge of the work Catholic Relief Services does around the globe. Help our viewers understand the significance of these program cuts.
Absolutely. So first of all, Catholic Relief Services was started in 1943. We are over 80 years old in terms of serving the most vulnerable people. Today, CRS works in about 120 of the poorest countries and serve over 130 million people. So just taking those numbers and the magnitude of that scope, We work with 2,000 partners around the world, and many of those are dioceses and parishes around the world. So when we say we're a global church working together, we really are. Sierra's work is in two types of intervention. First is emergency reliefs. So anytime when you have natural disasters or man-made disasters such as war, CRS is there as a first responder. We are there with food, shelter needs, medicine, sanitation, and the most fundamental needs that help people flourishing. And we are there too nowadays in different places because of the refugee dislocation. There are people who are in different countries, they need help. In addition to emergency, we also do long-term development, which is to help people move away from poverty by building up their own country assets, whether it is in agriculture or production, whether it is increasing people's education or their health, or building up organizations so that people could really achieve much better life from that. So this is the scope of CRS work, and it is quite comprehensive. You know, in the end, beyond emergency, we deal with health, health of infants, children, mothers, and grown people too. We deal with diseases, whether it is malaria or even Ebola. We deal with those. We deal with malnutrition when people don't have enough to eat. We deal with agricultural success. Because of the temperature changes and the climate patterns. So many soils and so on are depleted, or rainfall patterns cannot be counted on. So, and those affect many people, hundreds of millions of people in the world. So how do we help them in some ways to adjust to the new conditions? We also deal with education, for example, of young people, because education is the path up. So our work will also deal with water and sanitation, and also just and peace building.
Yes, and thank you so much for what you've done. The mission of CRS, and you mentioned this, is to serve the poorest and most vulnerable. In 2023, it worked in 120 countries, serving 200 million people. Americans who voted for Donald Trump largely said they supported America first. How does the work of CRS square with an American first agenda?
Absolutely. Actually, international aid was started at first for the benefit of the U.S., even though the aid goes overseas for two major reasons. One is security of the U.S. The other is prosperity. So on the first item of security, what we're trying to do is that when countries are successful, they tend to be more stable, and we don't deal with the same degree of terrorism or unrest. And sometimes the U.S. becomes a target when you have problems in different countries, when you have failed countries and so on. So security is achieved when countries are working well. There are not as many sort of incidences of conflicts or terrorism. In addition to that, it also allows us to have understanding and intelligence from that area. And most important is friendship and goodwill. That's what we're trying to build. So that's a security dimension. The other dimension is about prosperity. Look, most of the growth that we're going to see in the world is coming from outside of the United States. It's really in a lot of these developing countries. They have both population growth and economic growth. Those will become very important markets for the United States, not only for export, but there are very precious minerals, materials, food, and so on that would allow us to expand, you know, production. So for the U.S., in terms of both security and in terms of growth and economic prosperity, it benefits the U.S. as well as the other people. And I think it's sometimes you have to be careful. We say, oh, we would give it to the other people. We then have less for the U.S. This is a zero-sum type of mentality. But actually, it doesn't happen that way. When we invest in these other countries, we're actually investing in the base that allows all of us to grow. You know, if you think about, you know, the precious minerals and precious food products and so on that becomes available, we are all better off for that. And so we have to look at sort of the opportunities that the investment in other countries bring Americans. But I have to say, for Americans, we've had such a strong and respected tradition of helping other people. To, you know, we are in the Lenten season right now. We are a Christian country. And the whole idea is what we do is really to honor what God tells us to do, and that is to build the dignity and the sacredness of all people. That's what we're doing. And with all the resources we have, if we don't live that message, who should live that message? But that is exactly the message of the gospel.
Right. And Carolyn, we only have a minute left here. If you were directly addressing President Trump, Elon Musk, and Marco Rubio, what would be your message to them about why they should restore funding to USAID and, by extension, Catholic Relief Services?
Well, I would just make it very simple. It's the best investment you could make in the United States in terms of security, in terms of prosperity, but most important in terms of trust. And trust is a very important capital that we don't have, then we can't really do the work as well.
Carolyn, we really appreciate you sharing your insight and expertise. Thank you and God bless.
Thank you very much. Same to you.
News headlines are next in the Week in Review. News about a potential ceasefire in the war between Russia and Ukraine tops the Week in Review. A proposal brokered by the U.S. and agreed to by Ukraine is on the table, but it is not certain whether Russia will go along with it. Top diplomats from the U.S. and Ukraine met in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday to discuss an end to hostilities. Ukraine agreed to a 30-day ceasefire to allow time for talks to end the war. In exchange for that agreement, the U.S. resumed arms shipment and intelligence sharing to Ukraine, military assistance the Trump administration had cut off. On Friday, the Kremlin said it was cautiously optimistic about the prospect of peace. But President Vladimir Putin said he would agree to the proposal only if it, quote, eliminated the root causes of this crisis. He said the proposal required painstaking research. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called Putin's response evasive and manipulative. The seesaw back and forth of threatened tariffs against America's main trading partners continued this week. The Trump administration says it is trying to stop unfair trade imbalances. But reaction to the on-again, off-again announced tariffs has been confusion. On social media Thursday morning, President Trump vowed to put a 200% tariff on wine, champagne, and alcohol from European Union countries. While that hasn't happened yet, the administration did slap 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports on Wednesday. Canada is the largest steel supplier to the U.S. Leaders there swiftly hit back with reciprocal tariffs on all American steel products and other new taxes on U.S. products, from textiles to beef to bourbon. Saying they did not start and do not want a trade war with the U.S., Canada's foreign minister on Wednesday spoke directly to Americans.
There are no winners in a trade war. American friends, help us help you. Please help us end these tariffs as quickly as possible. And please talk to your elected representatives at the federal, at the state, and municipal level.
The rollout of Trump's trade policy continues to cause whiplash in the financial markets. The losses only intensified this week. On Thursday, massive sell-offs pushed the S&P 500 stock index into a correction, a drop in valuation of more than 10% since its most recent high. Financial analysts say investors are reacting to White House policies they fear could send the economy into a recession. New major layoffs in the federal workforce this week at the Education Department, where nearly half the staff was fired. A senior official said the department had failed to deliver on its mission and that the reductions would advance President Trump's goal of returning education to the states. Dismantling the Education Department has long been a goal of the president, but eliminating the department completely will require an act of Congress. Critics worry the layoffs will impact the department's ability to distribute grant money to school districts, monitor national education data, administer student loans, and deliver services for disabled students.
I'm afraid that the dollars that schools and districts have been relying on are going to just not be there. And it's one thing to phase out resources. It's another thing to cut them off just without a plan. And that really makes me nervous for the kids.
The department also announced further downsizing with a cancellation of leases on regional offices in San Francisco, New York, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, and Cleveland. Internal pushback from career employees has apparently helped to at least delay an Elon Musk DOGE plan to end customer service phone operations at the Social Security Administration. Staffers told the Washington Post that the Musk cost-cutting team was planning to shut down phone lines and tell customers to rely instead on in-person field office visits and the internet to process their claims and answer questions. The agency's toll-free number is a mainstay for older and disabled customers who do not have internet access or have trouble navigating websites. The phone lines remain open for now, but recent wait times have stretched into hours as DOGE downsizes the Social Security workforce. An update now on a story we brought you last month about the Trump administration's strategy to use Guantanamo Bay Naval Station in Cuba to house migrant detainees awaiting final deportation. Just weeks ago, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem visited Guantanamo as they announced up to 30,000 of the worst criminal aliens would be held there. Hegseth called it the perfect place to hold migrants. The U.S. military sent hundreds of troops to set up a tent facility at a cost of at least $16 million. But only a few hundred detainees ever arrived, many on expensive military transports, and now have all been flown off the island on ICE aircraft to a detention facility in Louisiana. It is unclear why they were routed back to the U.S., but the Defense Department confirms none of the 195 tents were ever used because they did not meet ICE housing standards. A member of the House Armed Services Committee who visited Guantanamo last week said she saw U.S. service members guarding empty tents. Former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is now in the custody of the International Criminal Court after a dramatic arrest in Manila on Tuesday. He is charged with crimes against humanity for starting a years-long and deadly war on drugs. Duterte made his first appearance before judges at The Hague through video link on Friday, where he was informed of the charges against him. Reaction to his detention has been fierce but divided. His supporters decried the arrest, even holding a candlelight vigil in the Philippines and protesting outside the ICC. But human rights advocates and loved ones of his victims praised his capture. Known as the Punisher, the 79-year-old's presidency is marked by a violent crackdown on drug pushers, killing thousands of people, many of them young men. A pretrial hearing will take place in September. The Senate pro-democracy activist Jimmy Lai was in Washington this week, asking the new administration to get his 77-year-old father out of a Hong Kong prison as soon as possible. A fierce advocate for Hong Kong's democracy, Lai was arrested in 2020. He faces several charges and has been in a drawn-out legal battle since 2023. He spent the last 4 years in prison and, if found guilty, could be sentenced for life. As Sebastian Lai shared on our program last year, the 77-year-old has now spent 4 years in solitary confinement without natural light. And though a devout Catholic, he has refused the Eucharist. On his latest trip to D.C., Sebastian shared his hope that President Trump could help his father find freedom before it's too late.
He's had an incredible record in getting people out of prison. The Hong Kong government is thuggish in how they've been treating my father and other political prisoners. And you know, I hope that he saves my father.
Earlier this month, Jimmy Lai presented his final testimony in court. Lawyers from both sides are expected to deliver closing statements in August. The Supreme Court has started to build its docket for its next term, now agreeing to look at Colorado's ban on what is commonly called conversion therapy for minors. A Christian counselor says the law violates her religious freedom because it prohibits Christian-based counseling for youth who struggle with same-sex attraction or gender identity. The case will likely be argued in the fall, with a decision released by summer 2026. This case could have far-ranging effects on the more than 20 states which have similar laws on the books.
We had to work with them and make sure that they know that we are with them and that they are not alone.
Ahead, he is America's only bishop born in Central America, an immigrant who came across the southern border, Bishop Evelio Menjivar, now a U.S. citizen. Gives us his pastoral advice on how the church should approach the immigration issue.
The visa used by thousands of foreign nuns to enter the United States is lapsing, effective right now. The EB-4 non-minister special immigrant visa allows religious organizations to sponsor workers who are not ministers to immigrate to the United States. They are used by nuns, religious brothers, monks, and lay missionaries to perform religious work. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops says not extending the visa program will have devastating effects on the church.
They play a very important role in the life of the church and the church's ministries, everything from providing religious instruction or teaching in Catholic schools to caring for our elderly and serving as chaplains in hospitals and on behalf of the military and our service members.
It appears the fate of a visa extension for religious workers and federal appropriations will be decided at least for this fiscal year in the current congressional budget process. A prominent Catholic clergyman from Central America came to the United States illegally when he was 20 years old, speaking no English. Now a U.S. citizen who received all his higher education in the United States, Bishop Evelio Menjivar has risen to become an auxiliary bishop of the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C. Bishop Menjivar explained to EWTN News in depth why he fled to America. A bloody civil war broke out in El Salvador in 1977 when he was a boy. Thousands of citizens were killed, their bodies often put on display. Many leaders in the Catholic Church spoke out against repression, murders, and human rights violations, including Catholic Archbishop Oscar Romero. For his outspokenness, he himself was gunned down while celebrating Mass in 1980. Thousands of Catholics came to the cathedral in San Salvador to mourn his death. Bishop Menjivar's family had to flee their village during the war and were under constant threat from soldiers and guerrillas. His father told him to flee north to the United States as conflict engulfed his country. With his unique perspective, we recently spoke to Bishop Menjivar at his parish, Our Lady Queen of the Americas in Washington. We asked him about his own journey, his pastoral guidance during a time when the topic of immigration is so divisive, and his hopes for the future. Bishop Menjivar spoke on the record with our Monse Alvarado. We began with what was happening at the time he left El Salvador.
Religious sisters, even American sisters, were killed. And then priests were, many priests were killed, catechists were killed. So that was the situation, and that is what pushed many people to leave the country.
How does that journey affect how you see the dialogue or difficult crisis that we're seeing today with immigrants and migrants?
Well, first of all, I don't feel proud that I crossed the border without documents. But it is a testimony that many people cross the border with good intentions. And I will say that that is very important because these days, I mean, people are just treated like criminals, but not everybody comes here with the intention of do harm. Most of immigrants come here because they do not find any other option in their countries, and they put their own lives at risk. But once we enter here, we contribute with our own talents, with our own energy. Most of immigrants come here when they are very young. I came here when I was 20 with a great desire to work hard, to go to school, to contribute to the well-being of this great nation that became my home country. As most immigrants do, I did janitorial work. I did construction, painting, youth ministry, you name it, all kind of blue-collar jobs. And so that helped me to understand labor, hard labor, to learn to work hard. My own story is the story of many people. I'm not unique, you know, and so many people, so many immigrants contributing in different ways to make the United States a great nation.
The reality for the church today, many people say that the future of the church is Latino or Hispanic, but it really is right now majority Latino, whether you're first or second generation related to the culture or not. And the Hispanic church doesn't have that representation in its leadership. You're one of very few bishops who come from Latin America and the first from Central America. What do you see changing? And do you see that this this elevation of those who come from this area will be helpful in helping the country through this difficult dialogue right now?
Well, I believe it is very important that the shepherds understand their flock. I mean, that bishops understand the church, but priests understand their parishioners. That is very important. So, yes, there are not many Hispanic bishops, but the number is just increasing. There are more and more, especially during the last years with Pope Francis. I mean, he understands very well the American church, and he has a great love for the American church, and he's very conscious of the needs of the church here. So, there are more Hispanic bishops, and one of the things that we need to do as a church is to promote more vocations to the priesthood. We need more Hispanic priests, that's for sure. We need more deacons. We need more religious sisters and brothers to serve the church.
You mentioned the Holy Father, and he recently sent a letter specifically to you and your brother bishops, and he asked you to remember human dignity in the issue of immigration, and especially associated with the political climate today, the way the rhetoric associated with those who are crossing the border, the way that we treat them, speak to them, and the way that the church responds. How did that make you feel?
I'm very thankful for that letter, because it is a beautiful expression of closeness, cercanía, of our universal shepherd to us who are trying to be pastors, to be shepherds of our flock entrusted to us. So first of all, I mean, we can feel how close the Holy Father is, and how much he understands the issues of the church here. He speaks as a pastor to pastors, and that is the beauty of the letter.
J.D. Vance at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast talked about his own conversion to the faith, his interfaith marriage, as well as how this, because he's new to the faith, he has made some missteps, and he will continue not to properly articulate some things. Do you have any advice for him as he continues on that faith journey?
It was very, very beautiful that he asked everybody to pray for the Pope's health. So that is a beautiful expression of his love. And obviously, you know, he has all the right to say whatever he said. And I will say that the Pope also, as a good pastor, you know, kind of send a message, not just to him, but to all of us, that we have to understand well the position of the Catholic Church and from where we receive the message, the command to walk with the poor and with the marginalized, and in this case with immigrants. And that is from Jesus. And that is from Jesus. And I will say that that is what the Pope says in the letter. You know, Jesus taught us to love everyone. And the parable of the Good Samaritan is a great example of how we have to love everyone, the strangers among us, when we see a need, a person in need, that is our neighbor. And so it was a beautiful message that the Holy Father sent, and I'm very thankful that and happy that Vice President Vance got the message.
Archbishop Perez let us know that within his diocese in Philadelphia, there's a lot of fear. There's a fear of ICE raids. There's a fear for those who want to be here and want to remain and have started making lives here. How do you feel that in this community, in the Archdiocese of Washington? Do you also have to pastor those who are in fear of being deported?
Yes, I'm a pastor for everyone. And there are communities that are, or people that are expressing fear and anxiety. Thanks be to God, we have also people that are very hopeful, I mean, people full of hope, and they know that this is the moment when they need the church the most, that they need to come as a community to pray. So, yes, we are seeing a lot of fear and a lot of uncertainty. People don't know what is going to happen to them. But one of the beautiful things that we are seeing here is that people, they continue going to church and celebrating their faith. So that is a good sign of their hope and their trust in the Lord.
Thank you so much, Your Excellency.
Thank you. Thank you.
There was much more to Monse's conversation with Bishop Menjivar. You can watch the full interview on the EWTN YouTube page. We'll be right back.
We're all there together experiencing the story of Jesus and all of us learning how loved we are and how much he wants a relationship with us.
Next, the story behind the play, The Thorn. We talked to the creator of the production about its decades-long run before small church youth groups and how it is now making a big splash in theaters across the country.
Week of Lent, a time to reflect and remember Jesus' love and sacrifice for us. One theater production touring the country seeks to remind us of that by illustrating the life of Jesus. The Thorn play tells the story of our Christ with live music, drama, and powerful performances. I spoke to the executive producer of The Thorn about how it all started, and I also met a Catholic cast member who has a faith journey to share.
Jesus on stage. The Thorn, a live-action theatrical performance that tells the story of Christ, is on tour in cities across the United States, just in time for the Lenten season. The story begins with the creation of the world and weaves through time, highlighting the story of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. The cast consists of more than 40 performers. Along with actors, there are musicians, dancers, and aerialists, combining choreography, music, and state-of-the-art visuals to create an experience for the audience. Executive producer Sarah Bolin says this play is a decades-long product.
It has slowly progressed as, again, like holding our hands open of like, oh, do you want us to do this again, Lord? What are you bringing? And so as he brings people to us, we figure out ways to make it part of the story.
The Thorn started off as a short skit in 1996. At the same time, Sarah and her husband John were youth pastors for an evangelical congregation at New Life Church in Colorado Springs.
One evening during youth group, a 16-year-old girl asked to speak to them and show them her arm, which had several cut marks from self-harming. John told the girl, "You don't have to do that because Jesus did that for you."
We've got to show these kids like the reality of what Jesus did for them and the price he paid so that they don't have to feel like they're alone in their struggles. He also wanted to show the battle, the supernatural battle for our hearts, minds, identity, all of those things.
Since that day, Sarah and John wanted to find a way to show Jesus' love and sacrifice. They created a skit and performed it in front of about 200 high school students. And for the next 10 years, The Thorn took the stage as an annual Easter tradition for their church. The show then became an independent production. Along the way, the Bolins met new friends, like performer Michael Gergenti. Gergenti grew up Catholic in Chicago, but as he got older, he fell away from the church. At 22, he moved to Los Angeles to pursue a career in music and acting. But after some time, he felt something was missing in his life.
There was this music producer who I was helping out who would pass out daily devotionals in his studio. And thankfully, you know, my heart was open the day that he gave me a devotional. And I actually took the time to read it. And, you know, not only did I read it, but I was just engulfed by the Holy Spirit.
He started going to Mass again and felt a special devotion to the rosary. Gergenti said since rediscovering his love for Jesus and the Catholic faith, he still wanted to act, but now with a different purpose.
It was this incredible blessing and just the sign that I needed from the Lord to pursue acting, but to make sure my eyes and heart were focused on him.
In The Thorn, he plays the role of Judas. Since then, Gergenti hasn't looked back. He continues to live his life full of faith and wants to send a message to the audience.
I hope that when people watch The Thorn, what they'll take away most is that Jesus loves you. I know that's very simple, but he loves you. He knows your name. And you are chosen. You have a purpose.
The Thorn is visiting 25 cities across the U.S. before Easter. For more information, visit www.thethorn.com. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Marcel Regis. Join us again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.